Welcome to the Reclaim Your Rise podcast. My name is Lauren Bongiorno, nationally board certified health coach and founder and CEO of Risley Health, where we help people and families impacted by type 1 diabetes take ownership over their lives so that they can transform with more freedom and confidence. Everyone has a different reason to be here. You might be seeking knowledge, support, or community, but at your core, I know that you long for something deeper. You're here for transformation. And that's what the Reclaim Your Rise podcast is all about.
My whole collapse with my diabetes was completely mental health. My A1C was never bad, but I just got into such a spiral of fear that I completely stopped living my life. And beforehand, I'd been a very serious traveler. I've been to like 30 countries, and I stopped all of that when I got scared from having diabetes. And so this was the first really big trip that I've been on since reclaiming my rise and coming back from that place of fear and feeling like myself again. And it helps to know, like, okay, you're in a good mental place. Yes, you're in a super remote area and you're climbing a mountain right now, but you're not scared of low blood sugar anymore. You have your supplies, you're prepared, and I could be in the moment and didn't have to worry about my equipment or having a low blood sugar. If it happened, I knew I could deal with it and I would be okay.
A quick reminder before we start the show that nothing you hear on the Reclaim Your Rise podcast should be a substitute for personalized professional medical advice. Please always consult your physician or other medical professional before making any changes to your diet, insulin dosages, or healthcare plan. This episode is brought to you by Omnipod. Heads up, everyone, and take out your calendars because I have an exciting announcement to make. Oh, I've been waiting to share this with you. So on Thursday, November 2nd, we are kicking off National Diabetes Awareness Month with, drumroll please, Rising Above T1D, a live virtual event for reclaiming your life with type 1 diabetes. I promise you, I am not just hyping this up. This event is going to be epic, and it's going to bring us all together from all over the world, all stages of diabetes, family, friends, caregivers, healthcare professionals. Spread the word because everyone is welcome, and it is going to be a party, I promise. My in-studio co-host this year is Neil Greathouse, otherwise known on social media as The Beaties, and whom is also a coach on the Risley team. I want you to think of this as 90 minutes of like diabetes reality TV, where for a night, diabetes doesn't have to be clinical and doesn't have to be dry and it doesn't have to be boring, but it's going to be something that combines community and connection and passion and energy and education and celebration and real conversations with an all-star guest panel and plenty of giveaways with a few surprises in store throughout. I see this truly as one of the most important things that the Risley team and myself do all year because it's a chance for all of us to really come together and remind ourselves and each other that yes, diabetes is a challenge we didn't choose, but it is one that we can rise above. So Rising Above T1D is free to attend, but you need to register. So use the link in the show notes below to save your spot. And I also want to encourage you today to share that link with at least three people that you know would want to know about the event. It can be on social media, LinkedIn, through email, through text message, but go ahead, sign up yourself, and then share the love with everyone else. All right, guys, see you there. Okay, I want you to imagine yourself getting diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and the following three things happening. One, you are discharged from the hospital after just 2 hours without receiving any education, only a diagnosis. Two, you are sent to the pharmacy to pick up insulin, but you're not taught how to use the insulin, or you're not given any rates or ratios to follow. And three, just a few days later, you leave for an 8-month study abroad trip to Barcelona and hope for the best. This is the experience of today's guest, Nicole Trone, who was diagnosed with T1D in 2018, but whom I first met in May of 2022 when she came to us to go through Risley's Decide and Conquer group coaching program, our 12-week program that we run for women with type 1 diabetes. Now, when I first met Nicole, she had extreme low blood sugar anxiety that stemmed from an experience that happened the night before she got engaged, a story that you'll hear about in a little bit. She was paralyzed, and I mean paralyzed, and so stuck not being able to build trust with her body's patterns. She was being dismissed by her care team as doing fine on paper by A1C standards, all while diabetes was taking up so much of her mental space and energy that she told me the first time we met, I can't even start planning my wedding. That is how debilitating my relationship with diabetes is. Now, Today, only a year and a half later, Nicole is a completely different person. You literally can't make it up. You're going to hear day and night, complete 180 flip, maybe one of the biggest transformations I've ever seen from a mindset perspective coming out of a Rizely coaching program. This is a must listen to episode and one that I really want to ask and encourage you to share on social media, on LinkedIn, whoever you think could benefit from it. More people need to understand the importance of a diabetes approach that includes education, mindset, and community. And Nicole's story really summarizes that in a nutshell. Oh, and I don't want to forget, we also talk about her new diabetic alert dog puppy and the fascinating way that diabetic alert dogs are trained. She goes through the whole process. It's very, very interesting. But anyways, let's get started. Without further ado, help me welcome my guest today, Nicole Trone, and let's rise. Nicole, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here with me today. I'm so giddy. I'm like really excited for this.
Oh, thank you for having me. Me too.
I feel like we're going to have to streamline this conversation or we could easily talk probably for like hours and hours and hours.
Yeah.
It could be, we could have a spinoff show. I know it. It's like After Dark with Lauren and Nicole, where we talk about all the things. I think there's such a unique bond that I think a lot of like the New York City Rizely alumni have because we see each other in person, often. I'm just like so comfortable with you. And I know I've made you, not like made you, but we've been in situations where I have, you know, had you share your story a lot of times. So when I was asked you to be on the podcast, I was like, can you just tell it once more?
Yeah, I'm an oversharer, so it works.
You are. And I didn't realize that about you in the beginning. Like you would say that, but then some of the meetups that we're at, I'm like, oh, she is an overshare, but like everyone loves it because you just lay it all on the table.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's get started. Let's jump into it. Nicole, can you share a story of a time that you reclaimed your rise with type 1 diabetes?
Yeah, I have a recent one. Originally, I wasn't sure what I was going to say because I feel like you have a lot of people on the show that are doing all these crazy big things like the stunt double and things like that. I don't have an out of the ordinary life. So I was really worried about what I was going to say at first, but I was just traveling, which kind of lended itself to being out of your routine and eating a bunch of food you don't normally eat. I was in the Middle East, so it was very hot. I was in very remote areas. And my whole collapse with my diabetes was completely mental health. My A1C was never bad, but I just got into such a spiral of fear that I completely stopped living my life. And beforehand, I'd been a very serious traveler. I've been to like 30 countries, and I stopped all of that when I got scared from having diabetes. And so this was the first really big trip that I've been on since reclaiming my rise and coming back from that place of fear and feeling like myself again. And it helps to know like, okay, you're in a good mental place. Yes, you're in a super remote area and you're climbing a mountain right now, but you're not scared of low blood sugar anymore. You have your supplies, you're prepared. And I could be in the moment and didn't have to worry about my equipment or having a low blood sugar. If it happened, I knew I could deal with it and I would be okay.
I wish we could. I wish we were advanced and had the high enough production to cut back to a year and a half ago when I first met you and we were over Zoom and you were literally crying, saying that you couldn't go for a walk with your fiance around Central Park without like having an anxiety attack because you were afraid of a low blood sugar.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think I'm a different person. And when I think about that time period, it almost feels like it wasn't me. Like I feel like it was an out of body experience, like a glitch in my life because I just had such a long period of not feeling like myself. And when I think back to it, it's like, I can talk about it, but I feel a little bit distanced from, I'm like, am I just talking about this because I truly remember it? Or is it, I've just said it enough times now because it just is so not me. I almost feel like I don't even remember it. It's like all a blur.
And that wasn't like 3 years ago. That wasn't 5 years ago. Not 10 years ago.
It was last year.
Yeah. Literally like this time. I mean, May, you came in the DCB program, May, 2022. So a little over a year ago.
Yeah.
I find something really interesting about what you shared about the trip and how you used to be such a traveler and then you got diagnosed and that relationship to travel changed because, you know, a lot of what I know about your story was as soon as you were diagnosed, you went to Spain, I believe. Yeah. And you weren't afraid after diagnosis to go to Spain, but it's what happened after that trip, that that relationship to that trip kind of like jerked you up a little bit. So can you share what happened there?
Yeah. So I was diagnosed in a super strange way. The abbreviated version of it basically was I went to the hospital and then I went home like 2 hours later. I never got checked into the hospital, didn't get any diabetes education at all. I just got sent straight home. So I never thought of diabetes as being that big of a deal, I guess. Also, I was so undereducated. I mean, I knew nothing about diabetes, so I was just completely ignorant. But I didn't think of it as being that much of a hindrance to my life because it didn't seem that way. I was only in the hospital for an hour. Like, I've been in the hospital longer for much less significant things. So I was like, I'm going to go to Spain. Like 2 days later, I went to Spain to study abroad. I was there for a long time and completely just like didn't think about diabetes at all because I just thought you didn't have to. I like didn't know you were supposed to take insulin before you ate. I was taking it after. I was not taking different insulin depending on what I was eating. It was like shooting up a full syringe, etc. But I was so happy. Like I was so happy to be abroad. I didn't have, thank God, any big incidents, no severe lows. I don't even know if I had a low. Like no severe highs that I know of. I wasn't on a Dexcom either at the time. So I was just completely, my life was unchanged. And it wasn't until probably I would say like close to 2 years after my diagnosis that I realized how scary diabetes can be. I had a really, really bad low and it broke me. Like I completely snapped. I became a totally different person because I realized insulin can kill me. So why would I want to put it in my body? And also I have to survive. So it created this loop of just being terrified of insulin, which is a really scary place to be when you need it to survive.
Really well said. And I've always, I it's hard to explain to somebody who doesn't have type 1 diabetes that like the amount of insulin that can kill you or yeah. Like it is so small. It's a little droplet and it's just like, it's wild that we just get to decide every day and guess how much insulin we should give for this. And there's no, you know, exact administration of how much we need to take on a daily basis.
Yeah. Especially doing that with no education. I mean, literally no education. I don't even think I knew. I could not have at that point in time, like I couldn't have even ballparked how many carbs were in a slice of bread for like the first 2.5 years of my diagnosis. Like I had no idea that you were supposed to do that.
Not to call them out, but like I need to know, what hospital was this?
It was Overlook in Summit, New Jersey, which is pretty good hospital. It's like New York City area hospital. Like I don't live in the middle of nowhere.
And what do you know, like, have you figured out since then, like, is that the normal experience when somebody gets diagnosed with type one or like, why were you,
I don't know. I know part of it, at least what they articulated. This is another thing that when I think about it, it's like, are these real memories or have I just said it enough times now that it's like, cause I just feel so disassociated with the whole experience at this point. But basically I went in there and I was not in DKA. So I think that that was a big component of it. I wasn't like rushed to the emergency room. I felt totally fine. I walked in there myself. They caught my diabetes in like primary care routine blood work. So I wasn't in there because I was having some severe incident. I mean, my blood sugar was like in the 800s, but I was not in DKA. So that was probably part of it. I think the bigger part of it was that because this was right around Christmas, it was Christmas Eve or like the day before Christmas Eve, they had kind of said something along the lines of like, not wanting to keep people in the hospital unnecessarily because it was the holidays and they were a little bit understaffed because they were giving people off over the holidays. And the doctor that I interacted with was not any kind of like endocrinology specialist. She was just a normal emergency room doctor. And another big contributor, I think, was that one of the first things my mom said is like, can I let her go to Barcelona? She's supposed to go to Barcelona in like 3 days. And the emergency room doctor was like, oh, I lived in Barcelona for a year. It's great. She's going to love it. And started talking about like restaurants and bars she used to like. So I think that was probably part of it too. It was like the coincidence of having somebody that knew what I was about to experience and wasn't thinking of it as that big of a deal because she herself had done it. So I think it was a combination of those things. But I don't actually know of anyone that I can think, maybe Megan Byer actually could speak to if that was a hospital she was at. But I don't know off the top of my head of any other diabetes diagnosis experiences there.
So you have that experience, you go away, nothing really happens, thank God, because I always say to you, I'm like, what a liability that would have been for the hospital. Like, we would have been all over that of like, you discharged her without any education, proper training.
Or insulin. I was discharged with no insulin.
Yeah. So you went to, how did you get your insulin? Like, what was?
So this is like Christmas Eve. I can't remember if it was Christmas Eve or the day before. I think it was actually the day before Christmas Eve, but I'm just like, consider it Christmas Eve in my head. We left the hospital at like 9:30 PM and the CVS pharmacy was closing at 9:30 PM. So my mom and I just like raced to CVS and the pharmacist was closing the gates and we were like, we need insulin. And she was like, what are you talking about? They didn't teach you how to do this at the hospital. My blood sugar was still like 350 at that point too. So it's not like I had even fully come down. And so we just showed up and asked the pharmacist for insulin. I think we must have had the prescription. I don't remember. Or the hospital had called it in, but she was in shock. Like, I mean, the pharmacist was in shock. And she never taught me how to use the insulin either, but she did give it to me. And then my mom and I went home that night and watched YouTube videos about it.
It just like you're going to pick up a bottle of Advil or like an antibiotic. Yeah. Like that's the equivalent of, oh yeah, we're just going to put this in, just go and pick it up.
Yeah. And the other layer of that was that we were picking it up for 8 months. It wasn't just like one vial of insulin. It was, she's never taken insulin before and she's about to move internationally for 8 months. So I needed to get 8 months worth of insulin. And honestly, I think I still have some of it.
Wow. I mean, if you hear stories too, just about, and I'm sure you've experienced it too, like afterwards, but just like getting supplies and how it can be challenging with like insurance and just all these loopholes, like you got so lucky.
So lucky. Yep.
Like every step of the way. I mean, you got also very unlucky in a lot of ways, but in other ways, it's like you got lucky. So take me now post Barcelona, you somehow make it through the trip. You come back, you have a bad low experience. Do you remember what that low was? Like, was it, 50? Yeah, so was it 30? Like, where were you at?
The thing that's so crazy in hindsight about that is this happened New Year's Eve of last year. So New Year's Eve coming into 2022. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't that low. The lowest I actually got was 70, I think. But what was so scary about the situation was I fell so fast that my body experienced it as if I was like 20. I was having the same, I was convulsing. I was falling so, so, so fast. And it was not just like a Dexcom lag where it or like a compression low where it looks like you're falling super fast and you're not. Whole thing was totally backed up with my glucometer too. I mean, I was just like crashing.
So you started at what, like 200, you were higher than that and then you gave a correction?
I think it was like 280 and I fell from 280 to 70 like shockingly fast. In hindsight, I don't even know how that's even possible for me to fall that fast. And that's what traumatized me because I got attached to the, well, if I can fall this fast, I'm not going to feel safe at any number. I was at 280 and then I fell that fast and started like having full body convulsions, how am I supposed to feel safe at any number going forward? If I fell from 280 that fast, I'm not going to feel safe at 150. And I think a lot of it was an education gap too. Not knowing what caused that fall was the scariest part because I didn't know when it was going to happen again or what contributed to it. So I was just living in constant fear of falling quickly like that again.
Right. I remember you telling me that story originally, and it's almost like that at the parks where it's that ride where you just like, you start at the top and it just drops down straight down. It's like that pit in your stomach of just like, whole, like not like the up and down roller coaster, but just like that drop is, I know that feeling. I get it. It's scary. Mm-hmm. So in the days after that, how did your life change in the sense of like, how did that low blood sugar anxiety impact your day to day, whether it was, you know, with your relationship to exercise or food or where you felt safe keeping your numbers?
Yeah. So pretty much right after that, I moved to Manhattan after COVID. I had lived in the city before and then went home for COVID, like a lot of people did, and was moving back in. So my fiance and I moved to Manhattan, and there's a lot more walking, and I felt like I was like immobile after that, because I think like 2 months had passed between when that low happened and when I moved, and I felt like I couldn't go anywhere because going somewhere here is walking, and I was plummeting like 100% of the time, or at least what I was considering plummeting at the time, which in hindsight probably wouldn't be that scary to me today, but coming off of that low was terrifying because I was just waiting for the shoe to drop.
Hmm. And you have a really unique experience, because a lot of people who have diabetes and a fear of lows, they'll keep themselves running. Like, we've had plenty of other clients where we've had to help them get from, you know, 250 feeling like a safe number to, you know, 150 feeling like their safe number. But for you, you were operating at like 75% time and range. So like, yeah, from the looks of it, and I'm sure when you went to your doctor, like everything looked great on paper, but so how were you able, like, what were you doing? Were you just like staying away from carbs? Like what were you actually doing?
Yeah, I was staying away from carbs, and I was purposely, I was definitely cutting back on insulin rather than, I guess I was trying to run myself high, but I was just cutting back on insulin. So I would consciously know like, okay, if I need to take 3 units for this meal, I'm only going to take 1.5. Hmm. But I was eating lower carb in general. So I think the result just wasn't me running that high. It was me running a little bit high, but not super, super high all the time. But I would run myself super high if I knew I had to walk or something after the fact. I would do that, just not when I was at home.
Right. So it was just this constant thinking all the time of, I'm not sure what's going to happen, but something could happen. So let me just err on the side of caution and not eat carbs, not have a lot of insulin on board. Like, that was your strategy.
Yeah, I was. It sounds absurd to say, but my mentality at the time was like, I was waiting to die at any second. Like, that's how I felt. Like, I just felt like I was going to collapse and die at any second. And it was irrational. And I know that. And I knew that in the moment that it was irrational, but I just didn't feel safe. I felt so, so, so in danger all the time. And I'm sure a lot of it too was, I had long COVID at the time and I had just moved, and there was just a lot going on in my life at the time as well. I don't know how I would have handled that if I was in a more stable situation otherwise, but I mean, it was so irrational. I snapped mentally.
So how did that, you were newly engaged at that point. Like, how did that impact your relationship and like that process? I know the answer for this, but I want you to share it.
So it's so interesting because my bad low happened the night before I got engaged. I think that's a big part of the hormones that were involved. I knew I was getting engaged at 7 a.m. the next morning as I was falling. And so I'm sure there was a lot of like hormonal adrenaline stuff going on that maybe I wasn't totally aware of at the time. But yeah, I got engaged literally the morning after I had that life-changing low. And what's interesting about my situation, I think, is that I had diabetes when my now fiance and I started dating, but very early on in my diabetes, when I was in a complete, this doesn't exist phase, not in a denial way. Like, a lot of people can get into a denial phase of like, I don't have diabetes. I was just ignorant, completely ignorant. So I was totally fine. I was completely happy. Diabetes didn't bother me at all. After I got home from Spain too, my A1C was never that bad either. So I was like pretty under control and just not really thinking about it. And just, I think, got lucky floating along and was happy. And then I think people in my life, not just him, but obviously he had to deal with most of it because we were living together. But I think he and everyone else around me, they were so confused where it had come from, because I think they would have expected that I would have been not okay in the beginning, not totally fine for the first 2-3 years, and then all of a sudden being terrified they couldn't wrap their heads around, like, you've been fine for the last 2 to 3 years. Why all of a sudden is this happening? And it's hard to explain the mentality of having a scary incident like that to someone that will never have to have one.
And it's a really good point that you make, because if you think about any other diagnosis, right, type 1 diabetes for a lot of people or anything else, it's like that diagnosis is the worst moment for most people. And then it gets better over time, I would say. Like, that's not like that the prognosis is going to get better, but the experience, and I think like the grieving, the loss of your freedom and your, you know, what your future holds and all that, like for you, it's like life proceeded as normal. And then all of a sudden, out of left field, this all happens.
And it was so confusing in the moment too. Like, when I was in my darkest times with my diabetes, my mental health, I would really beat myself up, like sitting on the sidewalk outside in Manhattan crying because I was having a low blood sugar and I was alone, and thinking like, how did I used to do this? Like, I've been doing this for 2 to 3 years and I've never been in this bad of a place. Like, how did I used to walk? Like, why can't I walk all of a sudden? Like, it just felt like, my mentality had changed. I keep saying I snapped, but it also felt like my body snapped in a way. And I think nothing had changed with my body. It was just my mindset had changed so dramatically that I was going about things totally differently than I had in the past without realizing it. But yeah, it was confusing in the moment too, for me to know like, where did this come from? I've been okay for 2 years. Why is this happening now? And I was totally playing the victim. Like, I was in such a woe is me place.
So what were your steps? Like, how did you reach out for help? Like, did you go seek out like the psychiatrist or a psychologist? Did you go to your endocrinologist? Like, what did you try that you thought like were your immediate lifelines that could help?
Yeah, I went to my endocrinologist and was met with, your numbers are fine. And I was sitting there crying, like actually crying. I cried for like months straight, it seems like, every time I talked about diabetes. But I was in there crying and like basically begging her for help. And she just was like, it's okay. You're being really hard on yourself. Your A1C is great. Your numbers are fine. Your time in range is good. Just looking at my Dexcom Clarity, obviously. And I was saying, like, I'm falling all the time. I'm going low all the time. And she was looking at my chart. She was like, well, you're only low 2% of the time. Which, yeah, maybe that's true. But the amount that I was thinking about being low and trying to prevent being low and being scared of being low and the amount of time being low was taking up in my head, it felt like I was low all the time. So I think we just had – there was just no time for me to explain that mindset. In the appointment that I had, it was just, your Clarity report looks good. Your A1C is good. You're doing a good job and you're just being too hard on yourself. And that was not my mindset. Like, I was not being hard on myself. That's not what was wrong. In no way was I being hard on myself. If anything, I was like coddling myself. I was not being hard on myself. I was just in a state of panic. Like, I was crying out of pure panic. It was not self-hate or anything. And after that, I had kind of like written off that endocrinologist because I was like, that's totally not what's happening. I feel like I can't be any more clear about it. This is not the avenue that I'm going to solve this problem. And there's nothing worse than going into a doctor's appointment and feeling so hopeful. Like, when you have something actually wrong that you that's really hindering your day-to-day life that you really want help with and you're trying to take an active role in fixing, there is nothing more upsetting than going into an appointment with this mindset of like, yes, I'm going to get some answers. I'm being productive. I'm taking an action step towards bettering myself. I can't wait to figure out what's wrong and start feeling better. And then leaving completely crushed, realizing that's not going to happen. Like, getting your hopes up, like, I just have to make it to this appointment. I have this appointment in 2 weeks and it's going to help me and I'm going to feel better and I'm going to get some answers and some support. And then leaving, that's not happening. It's like a crushing blow. At least it was for me. So I then tried to go to therapy, but I am a very action-minded person. Like, when I get into a bad mental state, I get panicky. I don't get depressive. I get panic, like hyperactive, like I need to fix this right now. So I was like, I need OCD therapy because I know that I've had OCD tendencies my whole life. I've gone through some bad flares of it before, and OCD therapy is extremely different than regular therapy. It's not at all talking about your feelings. It is straight up exposure and response prevention therapy. So you just rip off the Band-Aid and expose yourself to your biggest fears and let yourself like assimilate the anxiety. So you just, it's basically like you can teaching yourself, like you can do hard things without your coping skills, because in OCD coping skills are really the biggest hindrance, like compulsions. So I went the OCD therapy road and they were like, okay, well, you just need to like make yourself have a low blood sugar. I was like, I can't do that. They were like, you just have to like let your blood sugar be really low and like not do anything about it. And I was like, well, that I can't do that.
Right. It's like it's a hard really jump.
Apply in this situation. Or like I went through a phase where I was not trusting my Dexcom at all. So I was obsessively testing with a finger stick.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I will never forget when we first got on that call, you pulled up, we were on Zoom, you had a sheet. And like, I'm a blood sugar logger. I created the Diabetic Health Journal, love logging, big fan. I have never seen a piece of paper. You know what it reminded me of? You know, when you were like in school and the teacher would tell you like, okay, you're allowed like to bring kind of like quote unquote, like a cheat sheet, whatever you can fit on a X by X size paper, like you could have, and you kind of like write in like the super, super small font and everything. That's how many numbers were on one page. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah. And that's OCD. Yeah. That's a compulsion. Like I was so stressed about going low, falling, how fast I was falling. I didn't even want to wait the 5 minutes for the Dexcom. And also I didn't trust it at all. So I was obsessively finger pricking and like tracking everything. And I was not well, like it was coming out of not a productive Diabetic Health Journal type of tracking. It was a destructive, I would eat and sit at the table and log my blood sugar for like 2 hours, do nothing else. Like it, I can't even believe that I did that. But at the time, that's the mindset I was in. And that's a really good reflection of what kind of mental state I was in. And in OCD therapy, they were like, okay, well, just for a day, you're going to like turn off your blood sugar monitor and you're also not going to test with your finger prick. And I was like, I can't do that either. You know, like they kind of didn't get the medical side of it. And I felt like the endocrinologist didn't get the mental side of it. And so that's when I really hit my breaking point of like, I'm upset. I know I'm not okay. I know I'm being irrational. I'm trying so hard to do something about it and get help and take as many action steps as I possibly can to get out of this. And there's nowhere to go. So I felt like I was the only broken diabetic, basically.
Many people don't know this, which is why we've partnered with Omnipod to help spread the word. But did you know that if you're curious about trying the Omnipod 5 tubeless wearable system, you can do so with no commitment, no obligation, and even if your current pump is in warranty? Crazy, right? Omnipod truly wants to make it as easy as possible for you to test their new system out and see how great life can be with it. There are so many benefits, my two highlights being that the activity feature sets a temporary higher target for times where less insulin is needed, and it integrates with Dexcom G6 to automatically adjust insulin every 5 minutes. So if you want to get on a pump for the first time, or if you want to have more freedom without a tubed pump, you can see if you're eligible for a free trial by going to omnipod.com/rise. Fill out the quick form and they'll do the work to check insurance coverage for you. You can also view full safety information, instructions for use, and trial terms and conditions at omnipod.com/rise. Now, right back to the show. What I'm hearing too from all of this is that you recognize that you had a problem and you couldn't find the solution. So the solution that you were providing yourself was just out of the only tool that you had, which was just data, because you are a data person, like even in like your job, right? Like you are, okay, everybody really quick. So Nicole is like, anytime that she helps like organize like a New York City, like meetup or whatever, she's like, send it to me in a spreadsheet. Like, just like, give me a spreadsheet of it. And I'm like, this is how Nicole like speaks. This is her language in spreadsheet terms. So that was your default, but like, that doesn't that doesn't work because it's only like, it's not moving the needle forward. It's only kind of like maintaining and meeting yourself where you are like in that moment, but it's not helping progress or create any type of change for the next day.
Yeah, it was making things worse for sure. Because not only then was I not doing anything to help myself or get better, I was fully disengaged from everything going on around me. Mm-hmm. Like yeah. I even got to a couple nights where I was like, I have to stay up all night and check my blood sugar. Like I can't sleep. Like right. I wouldn't even let myself sleep. Like, I can't even believe that because that's so not me. And when I talk about that, it doesn't feel like it was me, but it was. It's like a reflection of how bad of a mental place I was in.
So in 1 year, you do a complete 180. What happened? How? Everyone's on the edge of their seat being like, well, how did you shift from that place to a different place?
Yeah. I think that I was talking about diabetes so much out of stress because I'm an oversharer that my phone like heard me talking about diabetes so much. And prior to this phase, I had never consumed any type of like diabetes content at all. In my first phase, I was totally ignorant. My steady state phase before my anxiety, I just like didn't want to hear about diabetes. I was like, I'm fine. I don't, whatever. I was not seeking out diabetes content.
Right.
All of a sudden, when I'm going through this bad mental phase, I started on my Instagram Explore tab getting fed diabetes content out of the blue. And so I am convinced it's because my phone heard me talking about it and was feeding me diabetes content in the Instagram algorithm. And your page came up, not the Rise of the Page, your page. And I was just like watching all of your reels, I remember. And I was like, okay, I should like really think about doing this, but I'm not going to do it right now. And like a couple weeks passed and I was like seeing you post about the DCB enrollment coming up. And I was like, no, I should really do this. So I signed up, you did my enrollment call. I signed up with you. So I had talked to you on the enrollment call and a couple weeks go by and I was kind of like, is this going to be worth it? Like, is this really going to change me? Like, I don't need community. That's kind of what I thought. I was like, these are all me problems. They're so unique to me. Other diabetics can go for a walk. Other diabetics are running marathons. Like, I'm having these problems. This is not a community issue. I need one-on-one help. But I joined the DCB. And so I was kind of having like maybe a little bit of post-purchase like anxiety about like, did I do the right thing? And then I saw you that day.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I ran into Lauren by complete coincidence at a local coffee shop to my apartment, my coffee shop that I go to work at. I ran into Lauren. And I just kind of took that as a sign from the universe. Like, you're in the right place. All of this is happening in such a weird way. You're not even really intentionally seeking this out. And it's kind of coming to you. Like, this is where you're supposed to be. So I went into it super, super seriously after that, because I just felt like I got confirmation that I was doing the right thing. And I think the Diabetic Health Journal helped me a lot. Being able to physically track, because I am a tracker, it was kind of a way to use those like comfort skills in a productive way and summarize my patterns and very slowly allowing myself to take more insulin was the biggest difference for me. The amount of insulin that I know I actually needed. And I think the first time I did it, actually, I was in like a one-on-one call with my coach at the time. And she was like, okay, let's do it together. And I feel like once I did it once or twice and nothing serious happened, I got a lot of my confidence back. And also just the education piece, once I learned about certain factors that outside of insulin affect your blood sugar, I was able to kind of like piece together the puzzle of why I fell so fast and had that scary experience. And so it made it easier for me to realize when I'm actually at risk for having a big fall versus when I'm probably not. So I was able to slowly tick off activities or times that were like safe. Like, oh, I don't have any insulin on board right now. Like, I can go for a walk and I don't have to worry. First thing in the morning, I'm on shots. So I take Lantus in the morning. So like first thing in the morning, if I don't have any insulin in my body at all, I can go for a walk and there's no way I'll fall. There's no way. But if I take 5 units and then go for a walk, I'm probably going to really seriously fall. Mm-hmm. And just knowing that and being able to plan around that actually made me feel like I have to plan less about my daily life. Like I feel like, okay, I know what's going to happen now. I don't have to like set aside 2 hours after I eat to wait before I go to my appointment because I don't want to fall walking there. I know how to plan for things now.
The way that I kind of think about it in my mind, and this happened for me as well, like watching everybody, you all go through coaching in that same experience and trajectory, like it every time reminds me of what I went through because it goes from this place of like, just kind of like operating separate from your diabetes and just guessing and like not having predictability to I know my blueprint and I am just operating with my diabetes. And it goes through a phase of like, yes, putting in more time and more energy towards it. But like ultimately at the end, you get to have more freedom. Like I remember a couple months ago, you texted me or you DM me on Instagram a picture of you eating a bagel. And you were like, the joy that I'm getting from eating this right now and giving the full amount of insulin and then going for a walk after where I think you walked there, something like that. You were just like ecstatic about it. And it's like those little precious moments that you earned.
Yeah. And I think those little moments too are the biggest in a way, because those are the things that I felt when I was denying myself those things, like when I was so scared to eat carbs in my bad mental health phase, I felt like I live in New York City and I can't have a bagel and everyone around me is eating bagels. Like those were the straws that broke the camel's back. Mm. I was like, diabetes is so bad and I'm in such a bad place that I can't even eat a bagel. Like something as simple as that, I can't do. Like, woe is me, this is not fair. So being able to have those little things back and feel like you're not excluded and you don't have to deny yourself those little things, I feel like those were worth way more than the big things.
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, for everybody listening too, I think that's the problem with solutions that exist in currently like in the bigger healthcare system is everything is so siloed, right? It's like, oh, mental health, go see this practitioner. Yeah. Oh, endocrinology, go see this. Oh, you need, you know, more education, go see this nutritionist and learn how to like count carbs in an apple. And it's just like, that is not like representative of real life, what is needed to go and navigate through real life experiences with type 1 diabetes. And so we've really found that the DCB, the group coaching program, of the three anchors together in one place of education, mindset, and community, like that is the trifecta that needs to exist.
Yeah. And it's, I think too, like as someone that went into the DCB not thinking that the community aspect was going to be very helpful for me personally, it made a huge difference. I don't think I would have gotten as much out of one-on-one coaching, honestly. Mm-hmm. I don't. Even though I thought that that's probably what I needed, it's not what I applied into, but I felt like going into it, that's probably what I needed. And I think the community ended up being the most important part for me, because now the DCB is over. I've been out of it for over a year now and I still made a lot of friends. And luckily I'm in New York and there are people that I see regularly now. And it's a support system that just keeps on growing. So yeah, it's kept me engaged in a way that I don't think I would be engaged if there was no community aspect to the coaching, for sure.
Yeah, I love seeing you and Sarah and Megan, all you guys get together, sometimes with me, sometimes without me, but either way, I'm so happy about it. Last thing that I want to talk about is, yes, you have overcome this fear of low. Yes, you eat more carbs and you're more active and you've increased your time and range from 75% to like in the 90s consistently. But let's talk about your diabetic alert dog and how that happened. And just, yeah, we've never had anybody talk about it on the show. And I'm like, we cannot forget to ask you. I mean, I know some of it and I found just like the training aspect of it. It's so interesting, but
Yeah. So I owe my diabetic alert dog credit to Sarah, who's also a Risley graduate. I had met Sarah in person at a Risley meetup and we followed each other on Instagram. And after the fact, she was super newly diagnosed at the time. And she's like, I have this 2-year-old dog. I'm going to train him to be a diabetic alert dog. I need to like make something good come out of this diagnosis. She was in her hospital bed Googling, how do I get a diabetic alert dog? And so she thankfully had already gone through the like research channel of finding out good cost-effective way to do it, et cetera. So I just, once I saw that she was doing that, I was like, I'm doing this too. I need you to tell me who you're using, and immediately got in contact. I already had a dog, a big dog, a Doberman, very smart dog, totally could have done it with her, but she's like a little bit old to start alert dog training. Dobermans have a lot of health problems. So I was like, I'm going to get another dog. I got a puppy, immediately started her in diabetic alert dog training. Our training company that I use is Medi Dogs. They're amazing and they're virtual and very accessible financially compared to the traditional alternative. And it is just the craziest, craziest thing to watch my puppy, who started alerting and has never missed an alert, by herself at 7 months old. And she's still a puppy, so she's not well behaved at all. She's nowhere near public access yet. But it is crazy to see a puppy that looks like out of control all the time be so smart and aware that they can sense a low blood sugar just by smelling it. And I don't even feel my lows. So it's like crazy that she can do it and I can't.
Can you share the three stages of training? Because I had no idea. Like, I was really just naive to the fact of like, how do you even train a dog to be alerting you with your numbers? So share those three stages that you had shared with me.
Yeah. Hopefully I can summarize this well, but the way I think about it in my head is the first stage, and I'm sure it's different for every dog too, but I started with a puppy. And so the way the scent training has gone for her is we first started with scent imprinting. So you basically soak your low blood sugar saliva samples in dental cotton and freeze it in a test tube. And every time they eat a meal, you tape the test tube to their bowl of dog food so that they start to associate eating with the scent of your low blood sugar. Again, my dog is super food driven. It's so much easier with dogs that are food motivated. Not all dogs are. So for a dog that's food motivated, their dog food is like their ultimate reward. So you want to like build an association of the scent with their ultimate reward. For some dogs that might be like praise or toy, but obviously it's easiest with food. So that's phase one. Separately from that, you teach them an alert behavior on cue. So similar to how you would teach a dog to shake or do any kind of trick, you teach them that when you say the word alert or whatever your cue word is, to do a behavior. I'm a super deep sleeper. I do not wake up to Dexcom alerts, no matter how loud they are, and neither does my fiance. So I knew that was a big motivation for me wanting to do service dog training in the first place, is I want another layer of protection at night. So I chose her alert behavior to be like hitting me super hard in the leg, really hard, scratching me in the leg because I'm such a deep sleeper. So I taught her basically, I would say shake and then pull my hand away so that instead of her paw landing in my hand, it would land on my leg. And I started using the word alert. So she then learned when I say alert, she has to hit me in the leg, totally separate from the scent. Then you start to put the scent and the alert together. So I would teach her to search for the scent. So after she was scent imprinted with the bowl, I would hide the test tube around the house and teach her to look for it. So I would hide her in the bedroom, open the door and say search. And when she found the test tube, I would just praise her like crazy. So to teach her, like, use your nose and seek out this scent and you're going to get a crazy reward when you find the source of it. Once she started doing that regularly, I would wait for her to find the scent. And then before I would praise her, I would say alert and she would hit me in the leg and then she'd get extra praise. And then eventually they're smart enough to realize like, oh, when I find this, she's going to tell me to alert. So you can just stop saying it and they'll do the behavior without the cue because they just are, they like short circuit and they fast forward and they know what's coming next. So they just do it anyway. And then you move on to like live on the body alerts. There's like little games you play in between to isolate like the actual low blood sugar scent from the scent of the dental cotton. You like use decoy tubes and all kinds of fun, like little games for them to just teach them that make sure they're going for the actual scent and not like looking for the tube or smelling the cotton or whatever. But yeah. And then eventually you can do on the body alerts. So same thing. Most people, when they go low and they're live low, they'll look at their dog and they'll say alert and teach them like, I mean, they smell the smell. They say, the trainers say that dog's scent is, I believe it's either 1,000 or 10,000 times human scent. So if you visualize, like if a human can see 1 mile, a dog can see 10 times that or whatever. So that's, there's no chance that they're missing the scent. Any dog would smell the scent. It's just teaching the dog to do a behavior when they smell the scent. And so she's now at a point where she, every time it's on my body, she alerts right away and she gets a big reward every time. And the next step will be nighttime alerts. And then high blood sugar alerts, because we're only doing low right now. So eventually it'll become such a innate behavior for them that they'll be able to wake themselves out of a deep sleep to alert you. And that's my ultimate goal. I want that more than the public access personally, because I want to feel safe going to sleep.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you regret waiting this long to get to train your dog to become a diabetic alert dog? Meaning, do you wish that you did this, let's say, back in May 2022 when you were panicking about having the low blood sugars and had a lot of anxiety around it? Or how do you relate to the timing of this?
No, I don't think I like had the mental capacity to do it at any other point. I totally needed to get my mental health under control before I could do something like this, because in a way it's very passive. Like, they're animals and they're instinctual and they're so smart. It is a lot less effort than you would think. But at the same time, it requires a lot of patience and being level-headed and not melting down when they're not doing it right, especially because you are doing it yourself. You have help from a trainer, but it's on Zoom. And so it's really all on you to like maintain your composure and stick with the practice in between sessions. And I could not have done that in a bad state. And I think before my bad state, I don't know if it's that I just like didn't care enough or if I used to wake up to my alarms more. I just now am realizing more recently, like, okay, I'm in a good place. And I'm sleeping through my alarms all the time. So that's kind of what really led me to do it. And I just can't remember if I used to sleep through alarms or if that's a new thing, but that's really the reason why I started doing it.
Got it. So yeah, because that's how I think of it too, is like the fact that you built your solution, like the getting the diabetic alert, training your dog to be a diabetic alert dog was not like the immediate solution. It was like you address the immediate solution with what you needed, the community, the education, the support. And then this is kind of like that bonus on top as a, okay, here's, you know, a great extension for my tool set moving forward.
Yeah. And I think its usefulness totally depends on the person as well. Like if you wake up to your nighttime alerts, it's not as helpful. I mean, it would be helpful in a situation where if you're having like a Dexcom inaccuracy or something, but it's not totally essential. But the way I feel it is the best applied is like little kids. I mean, if I were to down the line have a diabetic child, it would be instant. I would start diabetic alert dog training day one, because it's a totally different ball game, especially an infant when they like can't communicate. Oh. Like I'm having a low blood sugar, the dog would be the saving grace. Totally. Yeah, and it is emotional. Like you already love your animal. So to know that your animal can help you in this way is a super special bond.
Yeah, absolutely. I know my heart goes out to all the caregivers who have toddlers that have type one. It's just like, are they crying because they're low or are they crying because they're just, you know, hungry or tired or whatever it is. So, well, thank you for sharing about that with us. And for anybody interested, We can put some more information in the show notes below about the trainer that Nicole and both Sarah, our other alumni, uses. I would love to end with you just sharing kind of just what you would say to somebody who is stuck in that position, whether it's with a fear of low or whether it's just like a lot of their mental energy is going towards diabetes and they're not getting the support that they need. Like, what would you tell them to motivate them in order to like take a step in that right direction, whatever that might be for them?
Yeah. I think if I think about it as what I could go back and tell myself, I'm super quick to be, as soon as something negative happens, to be like, this is forever. I'm always going to be stuck in this place. This is never going to go away. I think you have to tell yourself, this is not forever. Like, this is temporary. I can get myself out of this. And I do think you have to be motivated to look for a solution. You can't expect anything to change without playing an active role in changing it. So at least invest some time in trying something to change your patterns in your day-to-day and see what works.
I love it. Great way to end, Nicole. Let's end on that note. Thank you so much for sharing everything with us. Like I said, we could have went on for hours and hours and hours. Maybe we'll have you back on in the future as you and your journey with diabetes evolves, but I so appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye everyone. See you next week. Thank you so much for being here with me today and listening to this episode of Reclaim Your Rise. To let us know that the episodes we're putting out are impactful and to help us get our street cred up and let everyone else know that this is something worthy of their time to listen to, please leave a rating and review on our Apple Podcasts, send the show to other people impacted by T1D or maybe even your doctor, and share it on social media tagging at Risley Health and at Lauren_Bongiorno. New episodes of Reclaim Your Rise come out every single Tuesday, so make sure you are subscribed to the podcast so that you never miss a beat. Thanks again for listening, and as always, remember, diabetes is a challenge that we did not choose, but one that we can rise above.